My name is Charlie, and I'm an alcoholic. You know, I'd like to start my talk by explaining my rap sheet from the city of Anaheim, because it tells you that I did a little drinking. I was a periodic, and my activities were so strange in between my periodic drunks that I forget to talk about drinking, really. Anyway, I don't know what you guys were doing in 1930, but I was 16 years old, and I was drunk down in Tijuana and had an altercation with a Mexican policeman. In 1932, my Sammo Hye Letterman sweater got caught on the door handle of a 1932 Dodge police car, and I couldn't escape from them, so I consider that an arrest. In 1947, I was arrested in West Los Angeles as a common drunk. In 1949, my wife divorced me because I was a drunk after 10 years of marriage. 1 year later, she married my best friend, Larry. And I missed Larry a lot for a long time. And 1 year later, 1950, I had married another young lady, and she had a baby, and then she divorced me because I was a drunk. And I'm standing in front of the judge, and he said, "I'm going to give your wife $100 a month for the next 21 years, I suppose, for the baby." I thought, "That's real nice of you, Your Honor. I'll try to give her a couple of bucks myself once in a while." In 1951, I was standing in front of the Malibu judge. He said, "What were you doing out there in the Pacific Coast Highway walking along in the rain and the mud at 3 o'clock in the morning?" I said, "Well, Your Honor, I'm a salesman, and I was planning to make a house call." He didn't buy that. He said, "What did you have in your hand?" I said, "Well, it was my briefcase." He said, "No, it says here you are dragging a bar stool along, of all things." In 1952, Santa Monica police got me on a drunk charge, and I was in jail for a while there. In 1953, Culver City had me on a drunken driving. In 1954, Torrance jail for a drunk in my car. In 1955, San Marino jail for drunk. I'm a little out of my orbit over there. I don't know what I was at. I went a little wide that night. In 1956, I was in the Wilshire Station Jail, transferred to Lincoln Heights for drunk and malicious mischief. Actually, it was my weird business partner got me involved in that damn thing. They arrested him for indecent exposure, but they couldn't convict him on account of insufficient evidence. You can see it's going to be a very sincere talk here tonight. In 1957, I was in Laguna Beach Jail for drunken driving. In 1958, in the Newport Beach Jail for drunken driving. In 1959, Orange County Jail for being drunk in my car. In 1960, in the Anaheim Jail for drunken driving. Okay. Now, I was a pretty industrious young kid. At 14 years of age, I opened an auto park down in Ocean Park. I graded the land. I put up the signs. And I beckoned the cars in and drained the gasoline out of them. So without drinking, I had some defects of character. I worked there for a while running that place, and then I moved over to a busier auto park where there was a lot of money changing hands there, and I started to knock down on the boss. Still not drinking. That's taking the boss's money when he isn't looking. Every fifth car, I'd take the money, and at midnight, I'd take it all when he went home. Still wasn't drinking. However, I did get through 3 years of college. I'm still a junior out there. No, I'm a senior at UCLA. That's right. It's some time ago. In that latter stage of about that time, a pretty good-looking girl began to park her car in that auto park, and I followed her home repeatedly. And I just began to worship the ground she walked on. It was almost a half acre up here in Brentwood. So I talked her into marrying me. Now I've got a millionaire father-in-law, swimming pool and a tennis court. I've changed businesses. I'm in the motion picture business at Republic Studios, helped name Roy Rogers. Gene Autry split, and Roy took his place, so we named him Roy Rogers. And I was put in charge of the restaurant bookkeeping because I'd studied accounting at UCLA, and every day I had to deposit $300 of receipts in the bank. But I wouldn't do it. I'd let it build up for a week. That'd be about $1,500, and I'd like to funnel that money. I couldn't take any of it because they were a pretty sharp bunch out there. But a remittance man asked me to cash a check for him. He was out of New York, and he was walking around there in a silk suit. And I acceded to his request and cashed a check for him. When we started out, I had the money and he had the experience. When we got through, I had the experience and he had the money. He was a smooth operator, that fellow. I had to go to my boss and explain to him what had happened. He took a long, cold, hard look at me, and I figured my days in that studio were just about over. My father-in-law came to my rescue. He said, "Charles, we don't like you working in the motion picture business. We would like you to get into heavy industry like other members of the family are occupied. And we've got a job lined up for you as an assistant to the purchasing agent of a large international corporation." And, of course, I took it. Well, for a couple of years, I behaved myself pretty well there. But I watched these requisitions and purchase orders going across my desk for hundreds of thousands of dollars, and I came up with a real brilliant idea. I set up a company on the outside, and in order to do that, you have to have somebody out there to run it. And I found a dishwasher, dressed him up, and he looked like he could own a company. The first money that I circuitously routed to him, anybody that's interested in the details, I'll talk to you about it after the meeting. But it's a matter of subcontracting and picking up the differential. The first money that I was available there was a hell of a hunk of a sum of money back there. I went to get it from him, and he said, "I own the company." I said, "You can't steal this money. It's already been stolen once. Give it to me, or we're both going to go to jail." Well, with that, he capitulated and gave me the money. I didn't have too much trouble with him from then on, but I started to have trouble with myself. Now, my wife had given birth to a couple of kids, and we lived in the neighborhood where my father-in-law lived, and he was beginning to look askance at my actions, because now with these $100 bills instead of dollar bills, I was staying out a little bit in the evenings and having a few drinks with the fellows. And he didn't like it when I forgot one time and didn't get home to my kids' birthday parties. So I was a little worried that I might lose my wife and kids if I didn't shape up, but I really was afraid I'd lose that father-in-law. He was a millionaire. I figured it was about time to close this scam up because thought I'd milked it pretty good and I had quite a hunk of money. And so I thought maybe I could salvage. It seemed to be going downhill, actually, is what I noticed. So I went down to the Malibu area and I picked out a piece of ground down there and I began to build a house. I thought maybe I could exorcise these devils that were in me by working with my own two hands. So I dug the footings. I did everything. I even made my own window frames. I built the septic tank, put in the wiring. I had to study the Uniform Building Code book in the mornings and then do the building in the afternoon. All the time I was doing this, an old fellow was bothering me. He was so drunk all the time, I couldn't understand him. But after about 9 months, I'd completed the place. And he said, "You know what you've done? You've built this house right in the middle of a riverbed. And every 7 years, the river runs right through here." I said, "Well, what year is this?" He said, "I think it's number 7 again." Well, I really didn't pay that much attention to him, even though I could understand him. But about 4 months later, it rained like it was raining here last night for several days, and here came that damn river, and it did. It ran right through my house, waist deep. Well, now, I'd been staying sober on beer while I was building that house. And now I started to drink whiskey again. Well, my wife had enjoyed this respite from my nefarious activities, and now she began to get a little hostile. She said, "What are you doing out there all hours of the night?" I said, "Well, I'm a leader of men. I'm a man of destiny." She said, "I think you're a follower of women." She apparently had come on little traces of lipstick or something on my collar. You know, if you fool around with them long enough, they'll turn on you. I don't care how great you think you are, you know. And as a matter of fact, what she started to do was to fool around with another guy while I was out drunk. He was the county coroner down there. And I resented this fellow because he was always cleaning his fingernails and talking to me about cadavers and tumors that he was working on in the daytime. I knew he was fooling around with my wife at night. I was afraid I'd catch some kind of damn exotic disease inadvertently. One night I came home and I could smell that formaldehyde smell in the house. And I knew, you know, that he'd been there. So I jumped on her on the bed and I began to choke her. Well, I was just kind of rattling her head around there when it caused her to lose her sense of humor completely. And the next morning she took the two kids and left. And I was kind of glad they were gone because now I could drink just the way I wanted to without anybody riding herd on me. So I drank for 3 days and three nights. The fourth morning I was quite I was astounded, I guess, to find that my hands were shaking. I was very fearful and anxious. I had a funny feeling and queasy feeling in my stomach. And I looked out the window and there was a fellow working on a telephone line out there, a telephone employee. And I hadn't paid my phone bill. Now, my mind had become so addled that I put these two ideas together and thought he was after me. I wanted to get something to eat or drink, so I went out the back door of this little house, down through the creek bed to the beach, along the sand, crawled up the bank to get into the little grocery store, which I could have readily reached by walking out the front door across a little bridge. So strange things were happening to my judgment and thinking. After a couple of weeks, I started to get a little lonely, and I saw a red-headed model standing in front of her beach house. She was about 5'8" inches tall, and I approached her, and we began to chat. And the first thing you know, we were cavorting around there after 2 or 3 days, and then I saw this fellow walking in and out of her house. I said, "Who is that?" She said, "Well, that's my husband." I said, "Well, doesn't he mind what's going on here and under his nose?" She said, "No, he's a hair fetishist. He has peculiar sexual propensities, inclinations, and idiosyncrasies." I said, "I don't know what you're talking about." So she got out a Polaroid picture that they'd taken. I don't know how they did this. They must have done it with a tripod. I couldn't make head or tail of the thing, actually. Little mounds of whipped cream, a sprinkling of nuts, and a maraschino cherry rightly placed. I thought, well, I'm going to have to take this gal out to dinner sometime, that's for sure. I went over there in about a week to take her out to dinner, and what happened was that I caught her with her husband. There they were on the floor. She completely understated his problem. Well, I didn't know how to handle a situation like that in those days, so I picked up a potted plant. It was a rubber tree they had on the porch, and I threw it through the plate glass window at them. Well, you know, no matter how drunk you are, you still know when you're in deep trouble. And I knew I was. So I ducked under the house down in the pilings with the seaweed down there and I waited for a couple of hours, very uncomfortable at night. And finally, I could hear that everybody had all calmed down. I went up and everybody had left. The husband, I said, "Where's your husband?" She says, "He's gone. I don't know where he went." The sheriffs had left. So I knew she was in trouble because she was just renting there. So I said, "Why don't you move across the highway into my house with me and we'll set up a little light housekeeping there because you're going to get thrown out of here anyway and my wife is gone." So we moved across. We took her chest of drawers. Then she had a little 1-foot-and-a-half high Ming tree that I'd gotten kind of fond of. It had a white rock base. So we moved that across the highway and we set up a little housekeeping over there. Now, this gal was different from my wife. When I went out and got drunk, she'd go out and get drunker. And she'd come in, and I don't know what she'd been up to out there, but she'd be mean when she got in. Well, you know how it is when you're out drunk. You get so tired, you've got to get home. And I would try to outlast her, but she'd always come in later, and she'd rip the covers off the bed and get my rifle out of the closet and point it at various portions of my anatomy. And I knew the thing had a hair trigger. And so chased me around my own house. I jumped literally from the frying pan right into the fire. Finally, it got so bad, I said, you know, I can't take this any longer. You're making me so nervous, you've just got to go. You're well-built and all that, but I just can't take it. So I pushed her out the door, and then I threw her chest of drawers out, and a little ming tree went out with all the white rock all over the front yard. And then, for some insane reason, I threw all my own furniture out, too. Well, we do strange things when we're drinking, and she circled around for a week or so and then came back. I don't know what's happened here lately. It doesn't seem to work that way for me anymore. I took a gal out the other night. I propositioned her. She turned me down, and I thanked her for it, actually. Anyway, she came on back, and we tried to make something out of it. She had a mercurial, quixotic personality. I found out later that it was due to marijuana and nervine, which is a bromide. And I like whiskey. I never got out into anything but alcohol. But at this juncture, my wife sent back one of the kids. Now, I never did like this damn kid too well, to tell you the truth. He was a gasoline sniffer, and but I was insane enough to think that I could make a little family unit out of this. So here we got a guy drinking whiskey and a gal on marijuana and nervine and the kid on gasoline, and I'm trying to make a family unit out of it. Just so it had no cohesiveness whatsoever. So after a period of time, I called my brother up in Santa Monica. I said, Harry, you're a bachelor. I'll sell you my house. I didn't tell him that the river was running through it, but I said, you're a bachelor. You need a little responsibility, so I'll throw a kid in for nothing, actually, sweeten the deal. He bought the package, and we lived there and rented from my brother for a while, and then I got a call from my brother. He said, Charles, you got to come up and help me with this kid. Well, I went up there, and I was horrified to see that he'd built a concrete block building, a little one, on the back of his residential lot, and he had the kid in there. And I looked in the window, and he's got open containers of gasoline, and he's smoking. I said, Harry, he's going to blow up the whole neighborhood if we don't get him out of there. He says, I can't get him out. He just comes out at night to get gasoline out of my car. I said, well, I know how to get him out of there. I went down to the liquor store, and I bought a half a gallon of wine, you know, with a big gold label on it, and I put it in the doorway, and I said, you get on one side, Harry. I'll be on the other. When he comes out, we'll ambush him. Well, he was like a rat in there. He was so smart. He wouldn't come out, and we didn't know it, but he'd switch from gasoline to ignition spray. Now, that really was his undoing, because he liked Lloyd's brand, which is the brand that Pep Boys puts out. Now, he had to go from Ocean Park clear over to Santa Monica to get this ignition spray, and that's where he became a cropper. He's the only guy I ever heard of that got 86 out of an auto parts store. Well, Christmas time rolled around, and my brother was getting real nervous around this situation. Christmas Eve came up, and here we are. And I should have been out in Encino in this ranch with a swimming pool and tennis court and the Japanese lanterns and the wealthy relatives. But here I am with my poor brother and my marijuana pill-popping concubine is there, and the kids on gasoline and ignition spray, and Uncle Louie come down from Alaska, and he is on Muscatel. He crawled out from under a railroad siding. So I said, Harry, this is the grimmest Christmas Eve I've ever been involved in. He said, well, we got to make the best of it, Charles. We won't exchange any presents, but why don't you get that mobile credit card out of your wallet, and we'll give it to that kid with a ribbon on it. And then he can get any kind of gasoline he wants. So, you know, that kid was really weird. He would spin around in the front yard and then run across the yard up the garage wall, and then on the other side was a big, tall fence, and he'd run right up that thing. He was very agile under the influence of these products. And so I ran down there to see what he was doing one day, and he was spinning around in the middle of the yard, and then he was Red Eagle on his back, and I looked at him, and I yelled up to Harry on the porch. I said, Harry, I think he's bought the farm. We don't have to fool with us anymore. I know how you Al-Anons feel about these characters. Harry yelled down at me, and he said, Charlie, there's nothing the matter with him. That's just the way he gets when he runs out of gas. He'll be all right. Now, I don't take any credit for that comment, because my brother was exercising an Al-Anon's rights, and that is to develop a sense of humor in an attempt to keep from going crazy. My brother finally got sick of me, and he threw me out. Now, here I was, had been an upstanding, rising young fellow. True enough, I had some defects of character. I might have been able to overcome them, but here I am now in 2nd and Broadway in the Carmel Hotel, and unable to take care of my property in person. That's what they put on my booking slips, and that's what they put on anybody's who's arrested for drunk. And they steal my watch, and then they take my money, these characters in this hotel. But there was sort of a click that would get it back for me. But I was a young alcoholic, but I was ready to do something about it when a friend of mine approached me and said, Charlie, what are you doing in this rat trap? We've got a two-year-old Buick convertible out here for you, and here's a sales talk, and here's a ballpoint pen, I guess. Now, go on out and practice on the public. If you score, you make a couple of $100. I suppose in conversion money would be a lot more than that. So I went out, and I was pretty good at it. The first week, I made, I think, about $800. The second week, I made $1,000. I said, I'm a $50,000 a year man, but I forgot one thing, and that was I had 3 bank accounts. There was no money in them, but I could float checks. So on about the third week, I went on a drunk, and when I came off of that, I was able to float checks. In those days, without this electronic bookkeeping, you could get almost a week's float from each account. And so then I finally covered. Excuse me. Well, I was, from then on, I really had no problem with money, but I sure was out of control. I remember I was so lonely. I remember running into a gal in a dry cleaning store. She was a customer. I followed her home, and I said to her at the door, would you like to buy this car? I pretended I was an automobile salesman, just as a ploy to get acquainted with her, and I don't know what she had in mind, but the first thing you know, we're fooling around after 2 or 3 days, and here's this guy running in and out of there. I said, who's that? She said, that's my husband. I thought, my God, another husband-in-law. I said, well, what's the trouble between you two? And she said, well, we just don't like each other. And I said, well, why don't we move then? We'll move over to Wilshire District. I know a nice apartment house, and I'd like to use his name, because the Bunko Squad was looking for us by now. And so I became Fred Lane. She was Elaine Lane. And then Fred had a peculiar sense of humor. He found us over there and moved in beside us. Didn't bother us at all. So it was I was trying to muddy the waters a little bit, but it's getting a little ridiculous, especially when he went out and found a gal by the name of Elaine and moved her in with him. Now we got 4 people living next door to each other with all the same names. And all I was trying to do was get a low profile, and it wasn't working. His Elaine was pretty sick, however, and she tried to commit suicide, so we all split, and I went down to Laguna and rented a place right beside the Coast Inn on the beach there, and I began to exercise all day long, and I didn't drink anything until 10 o'clock at night, and then I would get good and drunk and come home at 2 o'clock in the morning from the bar. I'd eat steak and eggs for breakfast and a big steak dinner, and actually in about 90 days I looked great. I had a good physical condition, and tan and healthy, and I was getting 8-10 hours of sleep a night, but that was those were my rules. But one morning at 2 o'clock, instead of going home, I went out to a party and drank until 5. I got so drunk that I passed out. That's different from sleeping. I woke up or came to in 2 hours, and I had to have a drink, and that started me off on a bender that wound me up, and as I mentioned there, in the Laguna Beach jail. Well, I was completely disgraced even by my group of friends that I'd gotten acquainted with there, so I moved up to Corona Del Mar. I figured I'd get married and straighten this thing out. I should have gone in the library and picked out marrying the librarian, but I didn't. I went into the bar, and I got a gal out of there, and the first thing you know, we were cohabitating, and we were trying to get married, but we were so drunk, or I was, nothing was happening. And finally, we moved up to Anaheim, and she straightened up pretty well and became an executive in a corporation. and it took about a year, excuse me. Well, anyway, we got married. A boss found out who she was married to and said, if you don't get rid of that bum, we're going to fire you. Well, that terrified me because she was the mainstay of our little operation. So we moved 50 miles out of town, and she commuted back and forth and told him that she'd gotten a divorce. Well, now I have to try to stay sober, so I'm drinking beer only again, and I'm lounging around that pool. I started to get so fat that I thought I better do something about it. So I came up with another one of my brilliant ideas. I mixed up a potion of grapefruit juice and vodka in the same chemical proportion as beer, and the first Sunday I drank 2 quarts of it. It didn't act like beer at all. As a matter of fact, I hit her in the jaw and knocked her in the bathtub and chipped one of her teeth. So the strange things were, that booze is funny. That's the same alcohol content even. I can't understand that to this day. Anyway, she split the scene and went down back to Anaheim, and I found her down there. She said, you know, I like to drink with you, but you get so crazy and insane when you drink. You're dangerous, and you get so sick, and you're so out of hand that it's a terrible proposition to be around you. Now, the landlady's having a party for her daughter here in a couple of weeks. She's getting married, and will you try to behave yourself? So the day rolled around, and the landlady had one bottle of whiskey on the card table out in the middle of the quad for 6 tenants. Well, I knew that was wrong, so I went over and got 5 more bottles. That's one for each of us. Well, you know what happened. The next morning, the Beacons van was there, and she was gone again. Well, I'm about at the end of this threnody because I'm covering 30 years of drinking and just bouncing off some of the tie tops here. But I'll tell you what a periodic is like. A lot of you know because you probably were. In my situation, I would look at my wife on a Sunday, and I'd be sober, and I'd say, don't you know anybody either around here? Can't we call somebody? We didn't know anybody anymore. We just weren't popular. And she said, just look at me. She said, I don't want to go to that damn stables. It just smells like a stable in there. I don't want to go there. And I'd slam the door and say, well, I'm going to Phoenix. I'm going to work over there. Well, I'm sober. And this is the way that obsession works, you see. It's so clever and diabolical that it knows that if it reveals itself, the obsession to drink, that we will thwart it. So it comes at us in a blind side. Now, it said, go to Phoenix and go to work over there. But when I got from Anaheim to Fullerton, I thought, that's an 8-hour drive. I better get a half a pint of whiskey. Well, that's ridiculous. When I got in the store, I said, it better be a fifth. And now I didn't get to Phoenix. I got as far as Riverside. And then I turned around, came back to the Normandy Hotel, where I knew I could cuff it. And I was drunk, and I was in there for 10 days on a terrible drunk, crawling around on my hands and knees. And, you know, I wound up on Alvarado Street in a flop house. I don't know how that happened. I was apparently blacked out or unconscious or something. But I'm on a pad in a flop house covered with lice. And when my wife found me, now, that's the way it worked for me. Well, I'll tell you. The last drunk I was on was in the Disney, well, it wasn't the Disneyland Hotel. It was another one of those dry periods when I looked at her and I couldn't figure out what was bothering her. I'm sober, and I said to her, I started to try to fight with her, and she wouldn't fight, argue. And finally, I got her so upset that she made some kind of a remark, which was my opening. Then I closed, and I slammed out the door, and I moved into the, it's now the Hyatt House. It used to be called the Chart House or something. Beautiful place. And I was going to live there the rest of my life. Sober. Can you believe this? And I got in there. The house doctor and I had a ginger ale together. And then the next day we had lunch together with some of the guests. And that evening I told the bartender, I said, I think I'll have a drink, but I'll run a straight shot. And here's my keys to my car. Don't let me have it. And by 11 o'clock, I was drunk and fighting him for the keys. And the next morning, the cab driver was there that I apparently engaged. And he said, your car is over at Smith Ford, and you're supposed to go over there and straighten things out. So I went over there, and the guy said, what did you do to this car? He said, all 4 wheels are bent, not this way, but notched in. and all four tires are blown out, and all your hubcaps are gone. He couldn't figure it out, and I couldn't tell him. I just had to buy four new wheels and four new tires and four new hubcaps and a wheel alignment, and that was the way that drunk wound up. Well, you see, about that time, there was a fellow in the hotel by the name of Frank. So I don't take any credit for getting to this program at all. Frank was a drunk, and I apparently had gotten acquainted with him. He said, I'm going to take you over to the Anaheim Alano Club, and you can make this program, this Alcoholics Anonymous program. I can't. I'm not even going to try. So he took me over. There were half a dozen guys in the room, and they were sitting around there, lounging around. One was a heavy equipment operator, another a meat comer, a butcher. The third one was a meat cutter, I was trying to say. A mailman, a lawyer, a heavy equipment operator. For some reason or other, I never can remember that sixth guy. But these fellows were unusual. I had lived for 30 years with no friends, really. Just if I got any acquaintance in the bar, it was buying them a drink or some kind of nonsense when I was half-canned. But these fellows took an interest in me, and I didn't even know their names. They just told me their first names. They were really anonymous, and their spirit was anonymous. They seemed to want to give me something. They were friendly. It made a real impression on me. That's one of the values of anonymity in this program. Anyway, they said, Charlie, we can't really tell you too much here. You're not in any condition to learn anything. And anyway, that isn't the way you get this program anyway. You gotta get identification. You gotta go to a lot of meetings so you hear hear our stories, and then you can put a picture of yourself together from all of this material, and finally you'll see who you really are. And that'll be the beginning of self-honesty for you. And also it'll probably be about the time when the obsession to drink will be removed. You may have the desire up to that time, but at that point the obsession probably will be removed. And I'd like to point out at this time that there's no defense against that obsession. If it's still lingering, we have no control over it. The definition of an obsession, by the way, out of the 12 and 12, is an idea with power all of its own. We can't even think our way out of our own insanity. So they said, now, why don't you come to some meetings? Well, here's how crazy I was and how I take so little credit for getting sober. On the way out of the door with Frank, I said, Frank, why don't we buy a fifth of Early Times? I'll spring for it, and I'll get back here next week. And he, in his insanity and in incapacity, said, no, you're going to come with me, and I'm going to shepherd you back here this evening, which he did, and I don't know whatever happened to Frank. But without him, I wouldn't be here, I'm quite sure, because, well, I don't know. Who can predict such a thing? In any event, I started to go to meetings. I got back with my wife. We bought a big mobile home, put it in a five-star park. I eventually was elected president of the Alano Club of Anaheim. My wife was a round-robin speaker in Al-Anon, and I've got about a year and a half of sobriety. And then my wife pulled something that no Al-Anon should ever pull on the president of the club. She went out and got drunk. And she was out there for 3 days, and when she came in, I was horrified after I pried out of her what she'd been up to. I went to all the members of the group and told them, they said, it's your wife you're talking about. I said, well, she's probably an alcoholic. I said, she's a son of a bitch is what she is. Yeah, I heard what she did. Well, we went through that hassle for a while, and then we finally got that ironed out. And then she took a look at me one day, and she said, you know, I don't really like you. Drunk or sober. And so she said, I'm going over to Long Beach and open up a women's boutique over there. And so I wouldn't go with her. I went down to Laguna. And I looked her up, however, and she had an apartment over the store, free rent. The store was making her a net of $150 a day in a warehouse. I moved in with her and her five kids and her husband. They were right there, not all living together, but right in, all involved. It was an embarrassing situation. I got such a resentment over it. I said, if I don't get off, I will move down in a warehouse finally. I said, I'm going to get drunk if I don't get over this resentment against you. She said, well, I'll tell you what you do. I learned this in Al-Anon. And I might mention that Al-Anon picked out of our program the very heart of it, and that's the business of release, or turning things over and quit fighting everything and everybody. And it's in our program. I don't think we stress it enough, but in any event, she said, here's what you do. You start to release me right now if you want to keep from getting drunk, because resentment is a killer. And in your book there it says, you find the resentment, you find the person to whom it's directed, you find the emotion or instinct that's running wild, and then you find the defect of character that fits the description, and the description of the defects of character are in the 12 and 12. So she said, probably what you're suffering from is, of all things, envy. I said, I don't have any, you haven't got anything I want. She said, you want my approval. That's what you want. And she said, you think you can get it by wanting it. And that's envy in practice, because you're not being realistic. I'm not going to give you approval, no matter how much you want it, until I'm ready to give it. And you can't get it by wanting it, but the excessive wanting of it is causing you to get crazy. And you're going to get drunk if you don't get rid of that feature. So I looked in the book and I said, by God, you're right. The principal problem of the alcoholic is his relationship with people and his attitude towards situations and institutions. And the problem therein that he has is that he's afraid he's not going to get something he wants, or he's going to lose something he has. Well, I'd nailed down a defect of character, which I never thought I had, was envy. It could have been gluttony or greed. I might have wanted that approval so much. She said, you also are unwilling to give me approval. And that also is a stupid procedure, because you can't cause me to do what you want me to do by failing to do it. And you apparently think that you can cause me to change if you don't give me approval. And it's not yours to dispense in the first place. I suppose if I did what you wanted me to do instantly, you'd give me the approval. That tends to make me believe that you think there's some kind of leverage involved there. So why don't you get rid of those two features? I said, how do I do that? Look in the book. You found the defects of character. You're on your way to a step four that's got some meaning and meat to it. The one you took before was nothing but a narrative. Now get ready to get rid of the defects of character that you've uncovered. Well, I was ready to get rid of them because I could see that they didn't work. They don't work. You cannot, defects of character don't do a damn thing. They don't accomplish anything. And here I've been living my whole life, not only with her, but with all of the people I was in contact on the basis of what I could get out of them and what I could keep from giving to them. And I was trapped in this morass. And here was the freedom that was available to me if I could just get this thing turned around. So step six says, when we're entirely ready to get rid of those defects of character, and I was, because they don't work, then we go to step seven and we ask God to take them away for us, because we can't do it by ourselves. Now at that juncture, I'm ready for a new adventure, because I'm out of my own way. It happened. I didn't believe it would happen. It didn't mean that my defects of character were reduced down to zero. They were just brought down to where I had normal emotions and instincts running wild. Not running wild anymore. The next proposition that came along was, and it's in the book, it's one of the promises. It says, when we get this kind of stuff done, working those steps, we take on a new partner, and he tells us what to do. He doesn't say, Charlie, here's what you do. It just seems that you know intuitively what to do. I went down to Figueroa Street. I got into the business that I'm still in now. And the result is that I've been able to take care of myself on a reasonable basis. The rest of my story is just pretty routine. I have made a living. I have lived a reasonably decent life. I could go back and recount, like in 1930 when I was fighting a Mexican cop, I went down to Puerto Vallarta to meet my daughter, my two daughters, my three grandchildren, and we were able to, through my daughter's having experience with her child being born without the ability to hear, to teach her how to talk, and it was a fantastic thing, and she was able then to pick up a little Mexican girl down there who was in a similar condition. She's back down there now doing that. All of my life has switched completely around. This, I have nothing to do with anything. I'm convinced that I'm powerless. My life is unmanageable, and things just seem to roll along real good. The kid is still out there. He thinks he can live on 45 cents a day. I don't know where that came from. He's got the essential essences of the ignition spray, and he buys it by the gallon. Now, I don't know how he's going to work out, but he's only 47. I'm going to give him until he's 48. That's when I got sober to straighten himself out. Thank you very much for having me. The red light just went off.